Matthew 5, verses 31 and 32. The 22nd talk in a series on the Gospel of Matthew was presented by Ron Julian on June 19, 2016, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're in Matthew, the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 5. We're only looking at two verses today. We're in Matthew 5, starting with verse 31. It was said, "Whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the reason of unchastity, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery." I find this passage difficult to talk about for two reasons. First of all, this is a highly debated passage when it comes to the specifics of what it is that Jesus means. It's difficult to know exactly what to say. There's a lot of difference of perspective among Christians and students of the Bible as to what's being said and how to apply it. And then the other thing is just that divorce is such a difficult topic. In one way or another, I think everyone here has been touched by it. I know some of you are divorced. Some of you come from broken homes. Probably all of us, in one way or another, are touched by divorce in some way through friends and family. So it makes it a difficult thing to talk about. So my approach, the way I'm thinking about this, is basically like this. You and I are here because we are disciples of Jesus. That means we are students of Jesus. We have gotten together. You're here listening to me not because I'm any great fount of wisdom, but because you and I together are students. We believe that Jesus is the Messiah. He is our teacher. He is our King and Master and Savior and all of that. So his perspective on this is something that we want to try to understand. So what I'm setting out to do here is talk about some of the, there are Old Testament issues, there are grammatical issues, there are cultural issues wrapped up in this. My goal is just to try to take us through those things and see if we can come out the other side with at least some material with which to try to understand what Jesus is getting at here. So that's what I'm going to try to do. First thing I would point out as we go into this is that this seems to be, starting in verse 31, really seems to me to follow, to go together with the verses that immediately precede it. Most of the little units in this section have a full-on phrase that starts them, like verse 21, "You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder." And then 27, "You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery." And then 33, again, "You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows," and so on. So each of these sections has this full something like, "You have heard that it was said," or "You have heard that the ancients were told." But our little section just starts with, "And it was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce." I think it's shorter because it is intended to go together with the part that precedes it. Notice that both of them are talking about adultery. Let me read the whole section here. Starting at 27, we talked about 27 and following last week. "You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you, for it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into hell, into Gehenna. And it was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the reason of unchastity, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. So I think it's significant that these go together, because really this is all part of that same thing that Jesus has been doing. As I see it, he's talking about what he said before, how our righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees. And so on the topic of divorce, as I'm picturing the way they approach it and what Jesus' critique is of this, they would look at the command to not commit adultery and they would say, okay, we have not committed adultery. I have not committed adultery. Therefore, I am a righteous person. I am the sort of person that God wants. I'm the sort of person who will enter into the kingdom of God. And Jesus then has two points to make. Well, first of all, let's talk about in the heart. Let's talk about nurturing and inflaming the lust of adultery for a woman that you are not married to. So you may have not committed the act, but at heart, in your intentions and pursuits inside, you are an adulterous person. And then this second part is meant to go right with that, I think. And likewise, I know that there's this commandment that talks about giving a certificate of divorce, but basically what you Pharisees are doing is using that commandment as a way to pursue a kind of legalized adultery. If you were to sleep with another woman while you're married to your wife, then that would be adultery. But if you give her a certificate of divorce and then go sleep with the other woman, now it's legal. Now you're following the law, because Moses said you should give a certificate of divorce. So this is my understanding of what it is that Jesus is doing in this section. It is another way of speaking to the self-righteousness of the Pharisees, that they would describe themselves, they would use the law to say, see, I am justified in my behavior, when in fact, what it amounts to is a deeper violation of what God's intent is, in this case, for marriage. So that's what I think is going on. So that's what we're going to try to pursue here. To begin with, I want to take us back into the Old Testament, the background to this stuff. It's difficult, actually, as we go into the Old Testament. There's not a lot in the Old Testament that talks about divorce. And in the law, particularly, the things that we have are a little strange. So, for example, so now we're in Leviticus chapter 21, and I am looking, starting with verse 6, we are talking about the priests. These are the regulations for the priests regarding marriage. It says, they shall be holy to their God and not profane the name of their God, for they present the offerings by fire to the Lord, the food of their God, so they shall be holy. They shall not take a woman who is profaned by harlotry, nor shall they take a woman divorced from her husband, for he is holy to his God. So there's this regulation for the priests that they can't marry a harlot and they can't marry a divorced woman. So the question arises at this point then, a priest can't marry a harlot or a divorced woman. Are those the same thing? Are they equally evil or something that the priest shouldn't be married to them? Well, a few verses later in 21:13 of Leviticus, we have the instructions for the high priest. And it says, he shall take a wife in her virginity, a widow or a divorced woman, or one who is profaned by harlotry, these he may not take, but rather he is to marry a virgin of his own people, so that he will not profane his offspring among his people, for I am the Lord who sanctifies him. Okay, so the high priest has an extra restriction. The high priest is not to marry a harlot, or a divorced woman, or a widow. Now clearly, it isn't that there is anything evil about being a widow. It's not anything she did wrong. Her husband died, so she's no longer married. There is nothing at all wrong in the law or in Israelite society with marrying a widow. It happens all the time. But for the purpose of the high priest, for the purposes of, I think, a symbolic religious purity, the high priest is only to marry a virgin to keep his offspring holy. Now, It would be interesting to try to sort out here exactly what God was intending to communicate by this. Let's remember, as we think about the law, that the law, the Mosaic law, is a complicated sort of thing. Part of it is intended to promote civil order among the Jews. So like a commandment that says that you're not to condemn someone on the basis of one witness. This is a civil commandment that helps to keep people from being railroaded by somebody who doesn't like them or something like that. Then we can have laws that are intended to communicate moral principles for the people, like you shall not covet your neighbor's house or your neighbor's wife. There we're talking about what is right and wrong, the sort of attitudes that you ought to pursue and not pursue. And then we have the laws that are sort of symbolic, ritual, religious. They're intended to embody some spiritual truth in a certain practice. So the one that always comes to my mind is the commandment about not mixing two different kinds of fabric in your clothing. It's not that that promotes civil order. It's not that that in and of itself is a moral issue, but it makes you think about God and what he wants. Every time you go, oh no, I can't wear that combo because that's mixing fabrics, it makes you think about how God doesn't want certain things mixed together. So the law is complex, and some of the laws have more than one of those aspects to them, and we're always facing that question when we look at the Old Testament law. What does it represent to us? Is this an unending principle that I ought to pursue, or how do I think about it? So we can see in this particular case that the law here regarding divorce, there's some mention of divorce here, is not really intended to spell out an abiding moral principle that you should not, for example, what we saw with the high priest, you should not marry a widow. That's not a moral principle for God. That's not something that he ever commanded, ever has commanded, except if you are a high priest who is involved in a religious, ritualistic aspect of the religion of Israel. So what does a passage like this tell us about divorce? It doesn't really tell us much. It doesn't really concern itself with the abiding principles related to the idea of divorce. It assumes that divorce is practiced in Israel. It assumes that there will be divorced women, so priests shouldn't marry them. But the real concern of this law is this ritual purity of the priests. As I've been saying, there is no law against a typical Israelite man marrying a divorced woman. But there is a law about a priest marrying a divorced woman. And presumably it has something to do with the fact that she has already had relations with another man. So it seems likely that the issue here is not a moral one, but a religious and symbolic one. There are only a handful of passages in the Mosaic Law that refer to divorce. And in the law part, the legal part of it, all of them, as far as I'm remembering at this point, are like this. All of them assume that divorce is happening in Israel, but there are some sort of restrictions that are put down that have something to do with ritual or religious purity. And I think the passage that Jesus is quoting is another passage like that. This is from Deuteronomy 24, 1. So this is the passage that Jesus is referring to in our passage. It says, Deuteronomy 24, 1, when a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out from his house, and she leaves his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, and if the latter husband turns against her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies, who took her to be his wife, then her former husband who sent her away is not allowed to take her again to be his wife, since she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. Okay, so we notice that this passage is not a straightforward command about divorce. It's not saying, for example, if your wife commits adultery or something, then you may legally divorce her, and here's how you do it. You give her a certificate. This passage is assuming that men will give certificates of divorce to their wives, but the passage is forbidding one particular thing. So a woman could be divorced by husband number one and marry husband number two. At that point, she could be divorced by husband number two, and it would be okay for her to go on and marry husband number three. In fact, she could do this until she went through every man in Israel, according to the law, and that would be fine, except one. And the one that she cannot marry is the original husband, the one that she was married to at the beginning. And it seems to me that the purpose of this law, again, is for its symbolic teaching value. When it says that she's defiled, she isn't defiled for anybody else to marry. It's not that she's a defiled woman in that sense, but for her, in terms of her original husband, she is defiled. I think the idea is something like that when a man divorces a woman and she marries someone else, that is the end of that marriage. That bond has been broken. She has joined with someone else, and to make clear how seriously God takes that, she is forbidden from marrying the first husband again. Well, we could talk about what is exactly the sense of it, what is involved with that, but my point here is, again, this is not intended to give instruction about divorce so much as it is intended to give a command that relates to one particular thing that might happen in the situation of divorce, and it is forbidden, evidently, it seems to me, not because it is inherently immoral, but because there is something deeply symbolic about that, that God is saying, I don't want that. I don't want that message being sent. At any rate, like I say, it is not intended to give general instruction on how divorce is to be handled and when you can do it and when you can't or anything like that, but it is the closest thing in the Old Testament to giving some sort of a description of how divorce should be handled. This brings us then to the Pharisees that Jesus is dealing with, because the Pharisees talked about this passage from Deuteronomy a lot. Since it is the passage that has the most to say about divorce, it actually talks about this process of a certificate and so on. This was the passage that they went to as they tried to sort out what was legal and what was not. My understanding is that among the Pharisees, divorce was common. The example is often given of Josephus, who you may know is a Jew who wrote about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Josephus described himself as a Pharisee, although people kick around exactly what that meant and to what extent that was actually true, or even if we're understanding him correctly. But it seems at least that Josephus is an example of the way many Jewish men thought about divorce. Josephus wrote, and these are quotes from various places that I put together here, "At this time I sent away my wife, being displeased with her behavior." And sent away means basically divorced. "Then I took as wife a woman from Crete. The man who wishes to be divorced from his wife for whatever cause, and among people many such may arise, must certify it in writing." Okay, so Josephus was describing his understanding of the Jewish practice concerning divorce, and he himself was an example of it. A man can have many reasons for wanting to be divorced, and the way to do it was to give the wife a written certificate, which is what he himself seems to have done with his wife, and he went and married someone else. Since divorce was common, the Pharisees were keenly interested in establishing exactly what the law did and did not allow. And there were two schools of thought. One was more strict, allowing divorce only for immorality, maybe adultery, at least some sort of loose or immoral conduct on the part of the wife. It might be a fairly broad category, but there had to be something of an immoral nature that the wife has done. The other school allowed divorce on most any grounds that caused the husband to be displeased with the wife. The one that always gets quoted is this sort of, she burns the toast or something. You could decide that you're not happy with her and divorce her and marry somebody else. So I don't imagine it said burns the toast. It's messed up the meal or something like that. Okay, so these debates about divorce centered on this passage that Jesus is referring to, because as I say, it's the one that has the most meat to it when it comes to divorce. Moses describes the first husband as divorcing his wife because of some indecency in her. And there's a Hebrew phrase there that is somewhat debated as to what exactly it means. And the Pharisees also debated what exactly it means. And so the more conservative Pharisees said, see, it is only legal to divorce if the wife has committed some indecency. So there has to be some moral affront. Although some of them would include as indecency things like going in public with her hair loose rather than being covered. So that was a wanton woman if she had done that, and that might be grounds for divorce. Moses describes the second husband, who then also divorces her, as saying literally, Moses says literally, if her second husband hates her and gives her a certificate of divorce. And the word hate can be used broadly. It can basically mean to be displeased with, to reject. And so the more liberal Pharisees could point to this and say, see, if the woman has done anything that makes the husband displeased with her, then he can divorce her. Taking it as if Moses is intending to give the grounds here for what made divorce legal or not. So this was a big topic of debate amongst the Pharisees. Later in Matthew, we come to this topic again because we see the Pharisees attempting to trap Jesus concerning this question. There's a big debate that's going on. So they, in Matthew 19:3, it says, some Pharisees came to Jesus testing him and asking, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all? And that was the debate among the Pharisees. Could a man divorce for pretty much any reason, as the liberals said? Or did the law require some kind of moral misbehavior on the part of the wife, as the conservatives said? So a common way of describing Jesus' answer is to say that he is the most conservative of the conservatives. He agrees that there must be moral grounds for divorce, but defines those grounds very narrowly as unchastity or immorality. So in the debate between the Pharisees, some people argue, Jesus is siding with the conservatives. However, he is advocating a standard that is at least as strict and probably more strict than that advocated by most of the conservatives. Okay, so there's some truth to that idea. Jesus' perspective is in some ways closer to the conservative Pharisees than the liberal Pharisees on this question. But I don't think that that captures really the essence of what Jesus is saying. I think in significant ways, Jesus is departing from both sides in this debate. He's looking at the question in another way. So in order to understand what I mean by that, we should probably at this point actually look at what he says in verse 32. This is going to be tricky, but let's gather up our courage and take a look. Verse 32, but I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife except for the cause of unchastity makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Okay, so unfortunately, there are a couple of big translation issues in this verse that are going to complicate us trying to understand what it is that Jesus says. First of all, the New American Standard Bible, for example, translates this, everyone who divorces his wife makes her commit adultery, it says, makes her commit adultery. Well, the debate here concerns the fact that the verb that we're translating commit adultery is in fact in the passive. And let me try to explain to you. It's difficult to make this distinction clear in English, so I'm going to make up a verb to clarify things a little bit. Instead of saying commit adultery, I'm going to semi-make up the verb adulterize. Okay, so if I commit adultery, I am adulterizing. All right? So I will translate then Jesus' second statement in verse 32 as whoever marries a divorced woman adulterizes. His first statement then, with the passive verb, would sound like this: everyone who divorces his wife makes her to be adulterized. Okay, so literally, again, it all depends on how you understand how the grammar is working here, but one typical way of understanding the grammar in this situation would be to say, everyone who divorces his wife makes her to be adulterized. So his whole statement would be, everyone who divorces his wife makes her to be adulterized, and whoever marries a divorced woman adulterizes. Okay, now again, we don't have a great word exactly in English to try to capture this, but I'm trying to show you that there is this possible distinction here. Now the debate concerns, what does it mean when he says, make her to be adulterized? What does that mean? Some argue that the passive does not have a true passive sense here, which is possible. We could make that argument. It should just be translated like the New American Standard does. He makes her commit adultery. I went and looked at a number of English translations, and most of them went this way, either makes her commit adultery, or even more strongly, makes her an adulteress. There are several, I think the Revised Standard says that, I think the New American NIV may say that, I forget. But most of the ones I looked at went in some direction like this. So if that's the case, then how could that be so? Well, typically for this argument, the assumption is that she will marry again. And when she marries again, then she will have committed adultery because she would have had sexual relations with a person who is not her first husband. I don't think this is the best explanation for what's going on here. I recognize that there are difficult questions involved, but I'm not inclined to think that that's what's going on. I think it is better to take the passive as having a true passive sense. He makes her to be adulterized. He makes her to be adulterated, or something like that. If that's the case, what does it mean? Well, scholars who argue for this option would typically translate it something like, he makes her the victim of adultery. He makes her to have adultery committed against her, or something like that. The husband, in other words, is not causing her to sin. He is causing her to be sinned against. David Crabtree argues for something even more specific here. He takes the passive sense. He points out that there are only a few examples of this word in the passive in all of Greek literature. And he notes that in the other contexts involving this word in the passive, that it involves the idea of the children of the marriage being made illegitimate. To be adulterized against is to call the legitimacy of the bloodline into question. And so David takes this as a metaphorical statement. His way of describing it is to make the wife to be adulterized means to treat her not as a legitimate wife, you're treating her like a mistress. So it's not talking about the actual legitimacy of the marriage and the children, but in essence, you're treating your wife as if the marriage were not legitimate. That's pretty good. I'm not sure. I really am not sure at this point. But whatever the specific sense of the word, it does seem to me most likely that we should retain the passive sense here. The husband is causing the wife to be adulterized, adulterated. She has become the victim in some sense of his adultery. Her marriage has been broken by him. He is not making her sin, he is sinning against her. I think that's the most likely way to take this language. It is adultery that we're talking about here because the husband's intention is to marry someone else. The whole point of divorce in Jewish culture was to have the legal freedom to marry someone else. In the Jewish writings that we have, the wording of the divorce decree to the wife was, "You are free to marry any man." Christians sometimes propose that Jesus is talking about divorcing someone and then not remarrying, but I don't see how that could make sense in this culture. To divorce was for the purpose of remarrying. If you don't remarry, you're not really divorcing the person. The whole point is to break off the connection, the unique connection with this person, so that I am free to have that connection with someone else. So Jesus' two points here are, I think, If you divorce your wife to marry another woman, you are making your wife the victim of adultery in some sense. And if you marry a divorced woman, then you are committing adultery because she is joined to another. I just remembered something that was earlier in the notes that I didn't say. Maybe this would be a good place to say it. As we were talking about last week, Jesus, in the section we looked at last week and in this section as well, is talking from the perspective of the man. In this case, again, he's aiming at the Pharisees, and they were men. But culturally speaking, divorce was something that was instituted by a man. And it didn't require a court or anything. The man just needed to write something that said, I release you from our marriage, and then he was free to go on and marry someone else, as I understand it. Now, the tricky part of that is the version of this language that we see in Mark, which is not this context, it's not from the Sermon on the Mount, it's from another context, but exactly the same issue is talked about. It does use the language about a woman divorcing her husband and then committing adultery by marrying another man. So I don't know quite what to do with that. It's possible that maybe, culturally speaking, things were loosening up a little bit and it was actually possible for a woman to divorce her husband. I'm not sure. It's possible that Jesus was just sort of speaking hypothetically to make the point that it's the same on either side. It's possible that this was in anticipation of what would be happening when the Gentiles came in as a part of his people, because it was much more prevalent for a woman to seek divorce outside of the Jewish culture. I don't know. I'm not sure. But it is kind of interesting that even Jesus himself does refer to the possibility that a woman would be the one instigating the divorce. But here, it's the typical Jewish practice that he's talking about, the man who is seeking. The man is either giving a divorce to his wife, or else he is a man looking for a wife, and he is marrying a woman who is divorced. There is a second translation issue in this verse. The New American Standard says, everyone who divorces his wife except for the cause of unchastity. And later in Matthew 19, New American Standard translates the same word, immorality. This word translated unchastity or immorality is the Greek word porneia, from which we get our word pornography. And this is a very hard word to pin down. I'm not settled in my mind at this point as to exactly what the range of meaning is for this. It has its roots in referring to prostitution. It can refer to immoralities of various sorts. It can refer to very technical violations of specific Jewish marriage customs, who it is you can and cannot marry. So it's a little bit hard for me to pin down exactly what it is that's being talked about here. It might be very specific, as in basically adultery or sexual immorality, or it could be broader, and I'm not entirely sure what to do with that. Another very interesting thing about this phrase, though, is that Matthew is the only one of the gospel writers who includes it. That is to say that in Mark and Luke, we see Jesus saying simply, everyone who divorces his wife commits adultery. No exceptions. Everyone who divorces his wife commits adultery. They don't include this exception clause that we see in Matthew. This is except for the cause of porneia. So naturally, there's a ton of debate among the scholars about what the significance is of that. Some would like to say that Matthew is deliberately trying to soften what Jesus actually said. Jesus himself gave no exceptions. That's what we see in Luke and Mark. But Matthew added the exception to tone down the harshness of what Jesus said. I think there's a much better explanation, and one that helps us to understand what Jesus is saying here, I think. It seems to me that the best explanation is that Mark and Luke did not include the exception because it was assumed. Matthew is only making explicit what everyone would have assumed anyway. Because the point is this, for a man to dump his wife and marry another woman is to adulterate the marriage. He is breaking the unique private bond between the wife and husband. But obviously, that is not true if the wife has already broken it. If the wife has in some way violated, abandoned the marriage, then the husband is not violating the marriage by marrying someone else because it has already been violated. I think everyone would have understood that. So Mark and Luke do not include that language because they think that it's obvious. Matthew includes that language to make explicit what is already implicit in Mark and Luke. To my mind, there is no substantial difference between Moses talking of the woman committing some indecency and Jesus talking of the woman's porneia. Both are implying that the woman has done something to violate the bond of marriage, and so the husband divorces her and marries someone else. Now, that may seem like a surprising thing to say, because it is very common to say that Jesus is disagreeing with Moses here. Moses speaks of giving a certificate of divorce, but Moses was wrong. He shouldn't have said that. Jesus is correcting him and saying that he doesn't allow divorce. To divorce is to commit adultery. So Moses was way too lenient on this stuff, and Jesus needs to come along and correct him. But that is not how I understand what's happening here. As I've been saying all along, Jesus is not disagreeing with the Old Testament. Jesus is saying that the Pharisees are misusing the Old Testament. That is my understanding of all of these passages that we're looking at here. Later in Matthew 19, Jesus says two things that make it very explicit how he sees the teaching of the Old Testament, I think are very helpful. So I'm just going to refer to these briefly sometime. If I ever get to Matthew 19, I will go into this in more detail. And of course, you'll remember everything I said here, so I won't have to repeat it. But okay, so first of all, he talks about how we should understand Moses' commandment. He says, because of the hardness of your hearts, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. That is, it would be wrong to take Moses as saying, as long as you keep the rules and give a certificate of divorce, you are a righteous person. That's not Moses' intent. Instead, I think Jesus would say that Moses would say, I know that sin is going to corrupt and destroy marriages. Divorce is going to happen because people have hard hearts. But there is this one thing. You cannot, because of religious reasons, remarry your first wife after she has married someone else. That doesn't mean that the rest of it is righteous, what a truly righteous person would do, but this is a regulation in the law. Okay, people are going to divorce. Okay, that's going to happen. But the law will not allow you to remarry your first wife if she's gone on to marry someone else. So he's not saying the righteous man writes a certificate of divorce. He's saying when sin destroys a marriage, the one thing you cannot do is remarry your original wife after she has married someone else. Secondly, we know that Moses was not advocating divorce as a righteous thing, at least if we assume that the same God who spoke in the beginning also was speaking to Moses, because in the creation account, God told us what marriage is. This is Jesus' other point. It is God himself making two lives into one flesh. So as Jesus says, what God has joined together, let no one separate. This comes later in Matthew, as I said, and so I'm not going to talk about it a lot now, but it is a very important example of how Jesus reads the scriptures. You can't just pull one verse out and say, see, here's the rule, and I'm following it. You have to interpret that verse in the light of what we know about God's character and purposes. So you can't understand Moses' statement about divorce if you ignore what Genesis tells us about God's purpose for marriage. So Jesus is treating the Old Testament as a coherent whole, embracing what Moses said just as much as what Genesis said, but saying this is how we need to put them in perspective with each other. When we look at the whole picture, you can't think that Moses is saying the righteous man will be righteous if he follows the rules for how he divorces, if he gives the proper certificate or something like that. You can't think that that's what Moses would be getting at, given what we know about God's purposes as they're revealed in the Old Testament. Okay, so let me see if I can pull things together here. This is very difficult. Throughout this section, I think, Jesus is addressing the way the Pharisees use the law. They see it as a set of rules that separate the good guys from the bad guys. They have not committed the act of adultery, so they are among the good guys. They have divorced their wives following the rules laid down by Moses, so they are the good guys. But Jesus is arguing that they are missing the point. As we saw last week, they are adulterers in their hearts when they refuse to submit to God's limits in their minds. They don't commit adultery with their bodies, but they fan the flames of adulterous lust in their minds. And so, in intention and in heart, they are rebelling against the limits that God has put upon them and are essentially adulterers. Likewise, the Pharisees were big practitioners of divorce, as I understand it. It would be bad if a man just starts sleeping with another woman other than his wife, because then he is committing adultery, and they don't break the rules. They don't commit adultery. But if he follows the rules from Moses, he can give the certificate of divorce, marry the new woman, and then sleep with her. Now he is a righteous man. But Jesus is saying that is not righteousness. God has joined you to your wife. You can't turn adultery into righteousness just by writing a certificate first. Okay, the question then becomes, how do we apply what Jesus has told us here? And I recognize that this is a very hard question. I have questions myself. I just want to tell you what makes the most sense to me at this point. First of all, I think it's fairly clear that there is no such thing as a righteous divorce. At least one of the spouses has committed a sin against God. Either the divorcing spouse is sinning by breaking and abandoning the marriage, or else the divorcing spouse is leaving because the other spouse has broken and abandoned the marriage. Or maybe there is a mixture of sin on both sides. That would not be uncommon. Okay, next, the sins involved in divorce are no different than any other sins. I think it is kind of sadly ironic how the church has used Jesus' teaching, and here's what I mean. Jesus is fighting the Pharisees who were busily parsing what Moses meant by the woman having some indecency so they could justify themselves. They were debating over what exactly qualified as indecency so they could assure themselves that they were following the rules. And unfortunately, sometimes I think we in the church have fallen into the same trap. We are busily parsing what Jesus means by the woman's porneia, so we can justify ourselves. We want to know exactly what qualifies as porneia, so we know whether we have broken the rules or not. Instead, I think we should treat Jesus' statement the way we treat his other statements in this section. It is a sin to try to hurt my brother with harsh words. It is a sin to nurture lust in my heart. It is a sin to use divorce as a kind of legalized adultery. So, what is God calling us to do? We take these things seriously. We strive to preserve our marriage commitment. We confess the sins that have led to the breakdown of our marriage. We do not do as the Pharisees do. That is, we do not attempt to justify ourselves by saying, look, the rules say you can't commit adultery, and the rules say you can give a certificate of divorce, so I'm okay. I'm okay is not an option here. Self-righteousness is out. Self-justification is out. Instead, we are to strive for what God calls good and humbly confess our true failures. It's the same in this situation as in any other. Many of us will not make the choice to divorce. Most of us have set out to hurt other people with our words. Many of us have inflamed the lusts of adultery in our minds. It all comes down to the same thing. I am either going to call what God says is good, good, pursue it, and acknowledge that I need God's forgiveness because I am not what I want to be, or else I am somehow going to try to pretend that there is not a problem here. That's what I think Jesus is dealing with. Sometimes it seems to me that the church has treated Jesus' teaching on divorce as if somehow Jesus is spelling out the unforgivable sin. Instead, I think, Jesus is charging the Pharisees with not taking God seriously, even as they are quoting passages from the law. marriage and divorce is one of those places where we as human beings are working out our relationship with God. It is just another one of those arenas where we are either blowing God off or else wrestling with him in truth. I don't think that Jesus is disagreeing with Moses about divorce being an accommodation to the hardness of our hearts. That is, I don't think Jesus is saying, Moses permitted divorce, but I don't. I think, rather, he's saying this. Moses recognized that human sin is going to destroy marriages, so he allowed for divorce. He did not mean that divorce was a righteous thing. Somebody's sin is involved, because God's purpose is that marriages would last. To follow God means to strive to keep your marriage vows, even if you would like to be married to someone else. Yes, sometimes the sin of one or both parties will leave a marriage violated and broken, and so divorce will be the result. But don't ever tell yourself that just because you followed the rules concerning divorce, you are a righteous person. To follow God means to take his view of marriage seriously and to confess your sins when you fail to do so. Okay, so a complicated and difficult topic, but that's what I've got to say about it. So we can take any questions or comments you might have.
So, Ron, I got a question about the Old Testament passage in Deuteronomy.
Yes.
Is that fair?
Everything's fair. Whether you're going to get a good answer or not is another question.
So when you were talking about it, it sounded very strange that the one thing that was prohibited was guy A divorces his wife, guy B marries, guy B divorces his wife, and then guy A remarries the same girl, right? That's the thing that's prohibited.
Yes.
Which is just kind of weird. So
tell me what the weirdness is. Is it because why would anyone do that? Is
yeah.
that what you, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. So I was thinking about the context of that and the social situation that they were in. And I started thinking about various situations in the Old Testament where women were given to men, like Sarah's maid is given to Abraham. Abraham also pretends that Sarah is his sister, and she then goes over to the Pharaoh and becomes his wife, essentially. And it seems like there were situations where women are given to other men. I'm wondering whether, if this was common enough, that the prohibition was against guy A making a deal with guy B, here, I'm going to give you my wife, and then when you're done with her, you can give her back to me, kind of thing.
Well, there's one thing that would mitigate against that he does describe the second husband. He says he hates her. That is, it's not that they had an arrangement that for a period of time she would be his wife. He gives her a divorce because he does not want her anymore. It's a rejection kind of thing, as I'm understanding it. So it sounds more like that if he had been pleased with her, that the purpose was that the marriage would continue on. But it's because he's decided that he didn't like her that he has now divorced her, as the first husband did.
So do you think it's more of a ritualistic kind of a defilement thing, or
yes.
not so much a practice in the culture that it was morally
right.
bad?
Right. See, your explanation, you're hitting it right on the head there. You're giving an underlying moral reason why this particular commandment would be given, and that's possible. That's not the way I'm understanding it right now. I'm understanding it that it is more along the lines of like the high priest being told he can't marry a widow, that there is something about that particular situation that even if it was not something that happened very often, it's given as a prohibition precisely to highlight the significance of the picture that's being evoked by it. That's how I'm taking it right now. Believe me, it's complicated and I could change my mind. So you may be right, but I'm inclined to see it as a more ritualistic kind of issue than not right now. That's
okay,
true.
Thanks. It's just weird. But.
Yeah. Well.
I was thinking about what you were saying about that divorce seems to have been a pretty common thing in these ancient cultures, at least. It was something that doesn't seem, at least, to have the stigma that it does in the church now.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, because now it feels like there are a lot of couples that I can think of, like, who have been part of the church who, it seems to me like, not this church, I'm just saying in general, mm-hmm. that it's like they'd rather not be married to each other, but there's this stigma around getting divorced. So they stay married, but, and they don't sleep with anybody else, but they're miserable and they're making each other miserable and they hate each other. And everybody can tell. And it's just kind of like, would that have happened as much, do you think? Or do you think like people would have just gotten divorced because it would have been sad and there it would have, Jesus is saying there's failure there. People have sinned here, but people would have just gotten divorced and gotten over it somehow.
Well, I don't know how to answer that question. Remember, by and large, as I understand it, is only half of the marriage that has the option of getting out. So the woman, if she is desperately unhappy with her husband's got no choice, culturally speaking. She doesn't have the option of a culturally accepted way out unless that's starting to change. I don't think it's changed a lot, but there's debate about that stuff. So there's that part of it. The stigma related to divorce in our culture comes from Christianity, and it comes from Jesus, the very words that we're reading here and others in the places where he debates with the Pharisees about what the acceptable grounds are for divorce and that stuff. The fact is that we have a hard time dealing with the explicit realities of human failure in the church, by and large. I'm not saying this is true, but this is true in a number of church environments, I think, where as long as you don't make it known that you have any sorts of struggles with anything, then you're fine, you're one of us. As soon as it becomes clear that you are not victorious in everything that you're doing, and obviously divorce is one of those very visible things, then it's like everybody gets uncomfortable. It's like, how am I supposed to? Jesus said, this is like adultery, so I want to be loving, but it just makes me uncomfortable. And we end up, in essence, kind of creating a culture where the people who fail at this or pretty much anything, if life makes it explicit to the people that there is failure here, we don't really know how to deal with it. So I think that stigma arises in part from a misunderstanding of what it means to forgive, to encourage each other in righteousness, to encourage each other to recognize that the choices in our life are about ultimately our eternal destiny and we need to take those choices very seriously, to embrace the mercy of God and together say, look, this is a serious situation, but God is a God who forgives people who mess up in serious situations. So all of that together, that involves a certain maturity, that involves a certain self-sacrifice on our part to be willing to live with the discomfort of dealing with those things. So that stigma is there. Now, I think I hear what you're saying, and I haven't dealt with what you're saying yet, which is perhaps the place where we have gone wrong is to actually make a big deal about divorce. Yeah, it's sin, but in that culture, it was a very typical thing to do, and so we shouldn't make a big deal of it, or we have made too big a deal of it, or something like that. I'm not comfortable with that way of thinking about it, because what we have is this double thing that's going on. This is what I tried to capture in saying, I am called as a person to submit to God's perspective on what is good. I am to abandon my selfish way of assessing the world, which is basically what is good is what benefits me in the way I want to be benefited, and to actually look at what I should pursue and look at my life in the light of what God's really about. So on the one hand, I am called to strive after marital fidelity and all the other things that Jesus is talking about here. And it's possible for a person to actually come to a place where making that kind of a choice is not just a particular moral failure at this particular spot in my life, but actually the issue of whether I am going to trust God and follow him or not has come to a head and I push God aside. I do not want to deal with him. So it can be very serious. Sin is always serious. Sometimes it can be very serious. And yet at the same time, we want to come alongside each other and say, all of us are struggling. All of us have moral failure. Let's not pretend otherwise. And let me encourage you to do what I am trying to do myself, which is to follow what God has called me to, and yet to count on the mercy of God in the midst of all of that stuff. I think that's what we're called to do. This is a very serious thing, but like I said, we have a God who reaches out and redeems people who are in the midst of serious failures. So, I don't know, that's maybe kind of a wayward sort of answer, but that's my answer.
No, I think you answered my question. And I think the heart of what I was asking was, does the actual act of divorce within this paradigm that Jesus is talking about, where he's showing the Pharisees that they're not really taking what God has prescribed seriously, if we take it as seriously as Jesus is saying, does the actual act of sending the woman away add anything to a potential situation where the man's basic, or the woman, I mean, if we talk about it in our culture, either or both of the couple have done that, essentially, but they're still living together. Like,
well,
what do you think about
yeah.
that?
Isn't that kind of a yes and no kind of situation? Because maybe it's not the same, but it strikes me as being the same as in the earlier thing when he talks about committing adultery in your heart.
Yeah.
On the one hand, it is, in fact, just as culpable before God. I am not a righteous person if I am fanning the flames of adulterous lust in my imagination. But at the same time, it's not that actually committing adultery, then I might as well go ahead because it's just the same thing. It's actually, it is an act that has consequences in people's lives. And so it is not only a rebellion against God's limitations on what I'm supposed to do, but it becomes an act of unloving and all of that kind of stuff. So I think it's kind of the same sort of thing, is that, yeah, in a sense, the damage is already done inside. But see, the point is that what Jesus is really talking about is, what does it mean to be a child of God, which the Pharisees would claim that they were? What does it mean to be a person who stands to enter into the kingdom of God? And so if we're thinking about it from that perspective, what it requires is, it doesn't really matter what the social implications of divorce or adultery or any of all those things are, really. What we're talking about is, where am I standing? What am I deciding in relationship to God? And what I'm saying that Jesus is calling us to is to take seriously what God calls good, to seek after that, to acknowledge when we fail to arrive at that, and to deal with it, to confess it, to be humbly acknowledging that we need God's mercy, to repent, all of that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think the issue of, I am unwilling to seek the good of my partner because I'm ticked off with them, as we're going to see later on, I'm called upon to love my enemies. So that's a failure right there. If I'm refusing to seek the good of my spouse because I have come to hate them because of the way they treat me or whatever. And then the further act of, I'm going to break the marriage commitment that I've made to this person because I want to be with somebody else. All of those are moral issues. All of those are issues of, what do I think about what God says about what the way life is to be lived? And frankly, all of them are areas where we will fall down in one way or another, because we are a combination. If we are children of God, as I would picture it, we have hearts that are open to the truth of God, and God gets through to us. We do repent because he brings us to the place where we can see what's going on. But we still are sinners who regularly face the problem that we are tempted and sometimes fall into making decisions that are not in keeping with what God has called us to. So it's a complicated thing. The problem with legalism, and by legalism here, what I mean is by defining righteousness in terms of, here are the legal requirements. If I have met them all, then that's what God wanted of me. The problem with legalism is that it is so easy for it to miss the essential point, which is not, have I done these things, but how am I oriented inside toward God? What am I going to do with him? Do I acknowledge that he has the right to tell me? I may be wrestling with it. I may struggle with it. I may fall and get up and fall again and get up and fall again. But am I striving to live in such a way that I acknowledge that God has the right to tell me what life is about? Or have I fundamentally blown him off? So no, that I wouldn't be willing to follow a God who would tell me that I have to give up that or I have to pursue that. That's where the rubber meets the road. And it's only possible for us to enter into that, from my perspective, because of the mercy of God. The mercy of God in opening our eyes and our hearts to be willing to pursue that, and the mercy of God in offering us forgiveness for the many stumbles that we make as we are seeking to follow him. I don't think it would be possible to stand up under the weight of what it is that God really wants from me as a human being if I didn't have the confidence that God is willing to overlook how much I fall short of that, which then gives me the incentive to pick myself up again and keep striving for that thing that God has called me to. So
thanks, Ron. I appreciate that.
Yeah. All right. We're done. Thanks.